And counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments. And you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Talcott Franklin. I am here for appellant Libramax Capital LLC. Jeff Grell is my local counsel with me, and I want to thank you for allowing me to appear here pro hoc. One point that we make early in the briefing that I think gets lost by the end is this, that respondent is bound by the servicing agreement, okay? That's not in dispute. And even though the PSA and the servicing agreement are an integrated contract, to quote respondent's brief at page 43, under New York law, even if related contracts are read as one, the different obligations within each contract may be independent and divisible. So the case respondent cites for that proposition is Creed versus 22nd Century. And in that case, you had two arguably integrated contracts with directly conflicting form selection clauses. And one party said, you know what? We need to integrate these contracts, and we've got to have the trial here in New York. And the court said, no, these contracts are integrated, that's true, but they have separate obligations. So we're going to have one trial here in New York, and we're going to have the other trial over in the other forum. So the case about one contract was one place, and the case about the other was the other because they had separate obligations. Now, this case is similar. There are two contracts, right?
But doesn't New York law apply just the substantive aspects of this case?
I'm sorry.
Doesn't substantive law, New York law, apply to the substantive aspects?
Correct, and that's why I'm going to New York law on the Creed case. Yes, you're absolutely right. Both contracts adopt New York law. So we're under New York law in terms of trying to figure out how to interpret these contracts. And, you know, I think respondent concedes that these are independent and divisible obligations anyway. They say themselves are two contracts.
So I thought you agreed with the district court's determination that the two should be read together, the PSA and the servicing agreement.
They should be. Okay. They have to be. So but they're also two different contracts. And that's the interesting thing. That's why I brought this up right away, because I want to go back to what the court said in New York. Because what the court said in New York was that even if you have contracts that should be integrated and read as one, the different obligations within each contract may be independent and divisible. And the reason for that is obvious. Why would you have, if you have to impose the obligations of one contract on the other, then you wouldn't have two contracts, right? You just have one single contract.
Can so I they ask sign. You, because And maybe I missed it in the briefing, but I want to make sure I understand this. What is the purpose for the servicing agreement? If the PSA controls the waterfall distributions, why? I mean, and that seems to be the key thing that you know, the administrator does, the securities administrator, is this waterfall distribution, because everyone wants to get their money. Why? What's the purpose of the servicing agreement?
It has several purposes. One key purpose is to govern certain aspects of the servicing of the loans. And one aspect of that, and the relevant aspect here, is what do you do when a loan goes bad? Because you got to go back a little bit in your mind to 2007 when everything was going and blowing and we're securitizing stuff right and left and housing values are never going to fall. Okay, so we don't have to worry about things like modifications, et cetera. But around 2007, around early to mid 2007, there began to be some stress in the subprime market. So people started to say, well, what happens if, you know, we have to modify these loans? What happens if borrowers get into trouble? Because these are adjustable rate loans. And I remember how the rates were going up and everyone was worried, everyone was going to. So they started thinking about modifications and putting something, addressing modifications into these documents. That's part of the servicing agreement, and that's why under the servicing agreement, they have a concept called advancing. And what the advances do is if there's expenses to the trust, related to foreclosure, et cetera, the servicer advances those expenses. And they also may advance principal, or excuse me, interest payments on loans that are going bad, so it's like nothing's going wrong. And the servicer expects to get paid back on those. So the servicer is going to essentially loan money to pay out the trust, and then they get paid back at a higher interest rate. So they like it because they're essentially making money.
And when do your clients benefit from this deal? When do the Class XP certificate holders benefit?
Whenever interest is paid. So they don't get paid principal, they just get paid interest. So every payment you make on your loan.
What part of the interest?
It's divided pro rata, actually. If you look at the PSA, I know they say it's different and they get paid later, but the reality is if you look at the definitions in the PSA, the division is pro rata.
So well, if there's a default, you don't get paid, right? Or
right, nobody gets paid.
Well, this is what I don't
go ahead, sorry.
Maybe I'm going to ask the same question.
Yeah,
we'll
go
see.
Ahead.
But if it's isn't it to your advantage for the servicer to reach a modification so that there isn't a default? I mean,
yeah, isn't about trying to stop modifications. Nobody's trying to stop modifications. The question was, so our client only gets paid interest on the loans, right? So as an interest-only buyer, there was a concern at that time that there wouldn't be interest because there might be modifications that eliminate interest payments altogether where someone's just paying back principal, okay? And so that's why this language is in the contract, is because the part that's at issue here, section 404, that says that we're going to pretend like when we modify a loan, we're going to pretend like the interest rate is the same. So if a modification takes place and we cut interest altogether, we're going to pretend for the buyer of the interest-only piece like interest is still being paid. Otherwise, those certificates aren't saleable on the market, right? Nobody's going to buy an interest-only certificate if there's a fear that interest is going to be reduced or eliminated because you'll never get back what you put into the deal in the first place.
Did anyone own the Class XP certificates before your client bought them?
Yeah, somebody did, yeah. So we weren't, Libermax didn't even exist in 2007.
So this issue wasn't raised by the prior owners of those certificates.
And it probably wouldn't have been because you didn't have massive modifications until later, so, right? The housing market, you got to remember, the housing market's going fine for the most part because, again, housing values are going up. So the issue doesn't come up until our client figures it out, basically, and brings it to the attention of the servicing administrator. Respondent.
Let me just get to the, because this, I could probably spend an hour with you, but we only have 15 minutes here. Do you believe that there is an ambiguity because of the two provisions?
No.
So you think it's clear and unambiguous?
It is clear and unambiguous,
all right, and why, I mean, how do you explain what apparently the respondents viewed as being a different, I mean, you disagree on what it says, I guess.
We don't even disagree on what it says. They know exactly what it says. Okay. They know that it means that we're going to pretend like an interest rate adjustment hasn't been made in a modification. They know what it means.
Oh, in the servicing agreement.
Right.
Is that vis-a-vis the actual, debtor?
Right. So each time a debtor's loan is modified, we're going to pretend under that language that we didn't modify the loan.
Is that consistent with the language in the PSA?
Yeah. The PSA doesn't address it. So what they say is that the XP certificate, this is our whole case, really. The XP certificate is an interest-only certificate, and it's subordinate to the A certificates, which is all that's left in the deal, A's and XP's.
Right, all the others,
but
B's, et cetera, are gone.
Right. If you read the definition of senior certificates in the PSA, it lists A, XP, and R. And then there's another definition of the PSA of subordinate certificates that lists M and B as subordinate. So the certificates do take we are a senior certificate. That is a complete fiction that they had their expert come in and testify to. But the reality is, and I had him testify at trial, I had him read the definition. It is, XP is a senior certificate. Well, so that's their
big inconsistency. And their expert also said that your interpretation would be contrary to industry practice.
Right. He did say that.
Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. So there are other deals where this happens, and they even put on a ton of testimony where the information happened to be in the PSA instead of the servicing agreement, but they put in a lot of testimony that this does happen. It just happens to be in the PSA instead of just in the servicing agreement. And, I mean, the reality
of the situation. Why is it put in the PSA?
Why wasn't it put in the PSA?
No, if it is used, why is it put in the PSA?
Typically because of, for convenience, really. I mean, why didn't it make it into the PSA on this deal? There's no explanation for that.
Convenience to whom? Why is it put in the PSA? Why is it convenient to put in the PSA?
I mean, there was no testimony on why some PSAs have this and some PSAs don't have it. The big issue here was that Wells Fargo failed to read the servicing agreement.
But when is there an ambiguity? I mean, if there's an ambiguity, the standard of review provides that we look to extrinsic evidence. And isn't there an ambiguity between the PSA and Section 404? Because the definition of mortgage rate is it's the annual rate at which interest accrues on such mortgage as adjusted from time to time in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note.
Right, you just nailed it. What you just said nailed it, okay? In accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note, interest rate adjusted from time to time in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note. Let that sink in, okay? What's a modification? Is that in accordance with the provisions of a mortgage note? No, that's a separate document that the borrower signs that reverses the provisions of the mortgage note.
Is there any evidence of that in the record? Do we have the mortgage note in the record?
We did. We put it in the record.
What exhibit is that?
Ooh, doing this from memory, but we have the mortgage note in evidence, and we also had testimony in evidence. So 262, I believe, is the mortgage note, and their own expert testified that we asked him what a modification was, and he said, it's an actual contractual document that's entered into between the servicer and the borrower amending the terms of the loan. And that's at the transcript 347.18 through 348.10. So once you understand that a modification of an interest rate is not an adjustment in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note, then respondent's primary argument falls apart. Because
the
change in the interest rates by modification.
Just to be clear, it's your assertion that the mortgage note doesn't have any language that provides for service modifications in it.
It doesn't.
It only provides for the mortgage rate being adjusted pursuant to some sort of index or other.
Right. What bank would enter a mortgage that says, oh, by the way, we might modify it? I mean, to your benefit. I mean, there's the interest rate, here it goes up and down. I mean, that was a huge controversy, was whether modifications could even be done in these trusts for a lot of them, because they didn't have language in servicing agreements that affected modifications. This one happens to have it, and then right below the stuff about, well, we can modify, and what do we do, how do we treat advances when we modify? Because that's why it's in the section that says advances, even though section headings don't matter. It says, you know, here's how we're going to treat loans when we modify. We're not going to advance on that interest. But even though we're not advancing, you're getting paid like we didn't modify at all.
What about the fact that the servicer was only providing the modified interest rate to Wells Fargo?
Right, they were, but that doesn't stop them from asking for them or getting them. And in the other deals, they were getting those, and that's their own people testified to that. So I mean, it's not like this is something unheard of that could never happen, because they put on other deals where the PSA talked about it. And you know, the crux of the issue really here to me is why do we have two contracts? And are you going to allow, since they agreed to be bound by the servicing agreement, are you then going to impose, as the district court did, are you going to impose on the servicing agreement all of the restrictions of the pooling and servicing agreement when the servicing agreement contains none of those restrictions? And Wells Fargo, look, they knew how to put restrictions into a document. They should have put them in the servicing agreement, but they didn't read it. And that's their fault and nobody else's. So there's, you know, if a borrower came in and said, oh, hey, I did a modification or this or that, and I want you to change it, Wells Fargo, you know what they'd say. They'd say, forget it. Your contract's a contract. I'm sorry you didn't read it. Tough luck. I'm out of time.
Okay. Thank you. Well, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm sure you'll use it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Kraus of DLA Piper for Wells Fargo.
Could we start right where he started? Let's start. Is there an ambiguity or not?
Yes.
There is an ambiguity.
There is an ambiguity.
Okay. Well, and let me look at it a different way. I mean, because, and this is what goes on, you know, I'm thinking, obviously, the Section 4.04 was written for a reason, and the way it is. And for some reason, and it's been very clear, apparently the administrator here looked at the PSA and said the PSA controls, and when we distribute money, we do so under the waterfall specifications, and those specifications said then applicable pass-through rate, which would include, then applicable would include anything, any rate that was paid, even a modified rate, right?
Am yes. I
correct? But then how do you explain the servicing agreement, which says this will not be considered, this modification will not be considered? I mean, why the two provisions? What was the purpose of the servicing agreement? And why the different, what appears, what is claimed to be, that it sets forth that it can't be, you know, that
sure.
You can't use that modification.
The answer is that from Wells Fargo's view, that language is in error. The petition that we filed, and as you know from the briefing, you know, put forth that the language in the servicing agreement, that one stray sentence at the bottom of the section that addresses advances, doesn't fit in with the rest of the trust at all, given the evidence that put forth, and we can go over some of that this afternoon. And so that's why Wells Fargo sought alternate forms of relief under the trust instruction statute.
But again, statutory construction, if there is an ambiguity, one of the canons of construction is we give effect to all the provisions of the contract, and we try to come up with something that gives effect to all those provisions. Why in this case are we not doing that?
We're not doing that because the court went through, first of all, determined that there was an ambiguity, and we need to go back over that.
Let's go over that. What is your argument that there's an ambiguity?
Sure, we have several arguments that there is an ambiguity. The first argument is if you look at, for example, Section 7.01 of the PSA, which establishes that the PSA is the sole source of the securities administrator's duties and obligations at all times. There's a number of provisions at the top of Section 7.01, and then on the following page at the top of Section 7.01, Romanet 1, that say precisely that. Sole source of securities duties and obligations at all times. If we look to the
What's the purpose of the servicing agreement?
Well, the servicing agreement gives, as to some degree, as Mr. Talcott explained, focuses on the role of the servicer and the servicer's responsibility to actively work with the loans in the day-to-day of taking in payments, transmitting them, dealing with delinquent loans, and so forth. They work together, but it's a separate purpose. I mean, the servicer, for example, is a party to the servicing agreement. The servicer is not a party to the PSA. So they, there's a number of documents that work in the trust. They don't all serve the same purpose. They perhaps complement each other and work together, but they are distinct. And so the securities administrator is looking at the PSA, and the PSA sets that up very expressly, that that's what the securities administrator is going to do. And that's why the securities administrator is looking at the PSA for purposes to determine what that waterfall is, how to calculate distributions, and how to make those distributions. It's not looking to the servicing agreement because its duties and obligations are found in the PSA. And we brought this language to life at the trial with testimony from
Going back to why there's an ambiguity, I mean, we don't get to the extrinsic evidence unless there's an ambiguity, correct? So simply because Section 701 of the PSA doesn't create an ambiguity necessarily unless there's some inconsistency between the other provisions of the PSA and Section 404 of the servicing agreement.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that, because as soon as I think ambiguity would exist, as soon as the securities administrator is being told it has to look to the servicing agreement in order to determine its duties and obligations.
What about the definition of mortgage rate? And that talks about the annual rate at which interest accrues on such loan as adjusted from time to time in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage. If you interpret that as Mr. Franklin suggests, then that would be the adjustable rate mortgage, not service modification. So there wouldn't be an ambiguity in that case.
Well, I don't think that it gets itself out of the ambiguity, because at that point the language is still the rate at which interest accrues on the mortgage loan.
Right, it says as adjusted from time to time in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note. So there would have to be some provision in the mortgage note that allowed that adjustment, correct?
Right. It recognizes that these are adjustable rate mortgages, and so that there's going to be adjustments, for example, to that interest rate as a product of being an ARM. But what it doesn't say is that the mortgage rate is something other than the actual rate at which interest accrues. I mean, it's the rate at which interest accrues as adjusted. It doesn't say other than...
What language in the PSA are you pointing to now?
I think we should be looking at the same language.
The mortgage rate definition?
Yes, the definition of mortgage rate.
4.01 of the PSA?
I think definition section is 1.01.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So you're still arguing about your interpretation of the definition of mortgage rate?
Well, I think that's what we were discussing, Your Honor.
Right. But I don't understand how that would... Explain to me how the definition of mortgage rate includes service modifications.
Because it is it's the then applicable. So it's you're looking at what's in effect at the time, and you're looking at the rate at which annual rate at which interest accrues on such mortgage loan.
So is your argument then that all this provision does is talk about the adjustment as interest rates fluctuate, the annual rate that is being charged on that?
I think that's right. And then, but that ultimately what it's directing, that the mortgage rate is going to be the then applicable rate, what's in effect at the time, and you look at the actual rate. It's nothing in the PSA that says you're going to look at the unmodified rate or the pre-modified rate.
Okay, so that's where your argument is, that the service agreement is in conflict with it, because then it does talk about actual modifications.
Correct, because it then alters those definitions. It alters the definition of mortgage rate and the net mortgage rate and net WAC rate and net pass-through rate and accrued certificate interest and all the way up.
And I'm still not understanding why you have two different agreements, because I'm looking at your brief and I'm trying to make sense of all of this, and I hope I get an answer from one or both of you on this issue. But obviously, as a court, we want to find that they work together. In your brief, you indicated that the servicing agreement is the contract that governs how the servicer handles the underlying individual mortgage loans.
Correct.
And I think without any question, the PSA handles how the waterfall distribution is made.
Correct.
All right. So in that, in the servicing agreement, it says the mortgage rate and net mortgage rate as to any mortgage loan will be deemed not reduced by any servicing modification, so that the calculation of accrued note interest payable on the offered certificates will not be affected by the servicing modifications. Could this be construed, would this only apply to the debtor? In other words, the debtor, even though the debtor may be given more time to pay, that he still has to pay the full amount of the note as it was originally written. I mean, is that a way to resolve what might be a conflict?
Your Honor, that may be a way to resolve it because it would then take it out of the waterfall and it would be more in line with the role of the servicing agreement as opposed to the role of the PSA, which is to govern the waterfall and to address the distributions to the holders.
And since the PSA says the as applied, then that's as applied is the actual rate that was utilized and received.
Correct.
Right? And that would make sense.
Right. That would be a way of resolving it.
So that would eliminate the ambiguity.
Right. If that sentence didn't affect the waterfall, then it would remove any conflict.
That's the only way I could rationalize this, because otherwise, why would this Wells Fargo not even read the servicing agreement, except that vis-a-vis the waterfall distribution, they viewed that as not applying necessarily? I mean, I'm trying to make some reason
out of this. I don't know the testimony was that Wells Fargo did not read the servicing
agreement.
At all. I know that's Libermax's contention trial record. I don't think reflects that. There's a dispute over one section of the servicing agreement. But I think ultimately it goes to the major point, which is as the securities administrator, the Wells Fargo in that capacity looks at the PSA. It looks to that waterfall in the PSA in order to determine how to make the distributions, how to calculate those distributions. It's not looking at other documents for that purpose because they serve different purposes.
Okay.
Can I ask you? I'm sorry, do you want to follow
up? Well, I just want to complete my thought here. Who wins, who loses in this deal? And it sounded like you're claiming that the Class A people get paid first and that they would be the losers if the appellants prevail here. But now I'm hearing that from the appellants that they're claiming that they're both seniors, so that this isn't correct. So I need you to explain
that. The answer is that with Libermax's interpretation, not surprisingly, Class XP wins and Class A loses. And that's frankly another reason for the ambiguity, because grafting on this section from the servicing agreement, this one sentence.
How does Class A lose?
Class A loses because if there's a servicing modification, the Class XP receives more and Class A receives less. I mean, that's the reason that Class XP has objected, is because Class XP says that the way Wells Fargo has been doling out, paying out the distributions, and Wells Fargo doesn't have any stake one way or the other in this, that it's been good, that money has been going to Class A, that should be going to Class XP. And so there's no dispute about that. And there's also no dispute about why that occurs and how that occurs in the documents. Yes, they're both labeled for
but
purposes.
You're arguing that in your brief you state that Libermax's interpretation would reverse the fundamental risk allocation among the senior and derivative classes. Libermax argues that you're both in the senior class. Explain your position on that.
Sure, because when we look at the PSA, there's no question Class XP is a derivative certificate. It's a strip that's layered on, and what Class XP receives is excess interest, if any, that isn't necessary to pay and now let's just Class A, which is all that's left. So when we, this is in the PSA, it's section 4.01B, and then also section 4.08. These are very dense provisions. But the way it works is that Class A is paid first, bears the lowest risk of loss. It suffers credit loss only once the balance on all other certificates have been reduced to zero. Class XP is the most risk of the two because it exists to capture excess interest. So if you have a loan modification in lieu of default, the purpose is to try to salvage some payment instead of having it go bad entirely. And so what would, when you have, in that circumstance, the risk is to XP, is not to A, because A is last in terms of the potential for risk. And when we look at the PSA provides, each month, Class XP will be paid only if Class A is paid in full. And if Class A isn't paid in full, then Class XP gets nothing. That's just reading the PSA, section 4.01B and section 4.08. And in, frankly, Class XP may get nothing even if Class A is paid in full, because on top of that, they have this net WAC reserve fund. And before Class XP gets paid, then that reserve fund has to get paid. But if we were to graft on this sentence from the servicing agreement, then what would happen is that this gets reversed. And Class XP gets paid more, and Class A gets paid less, even though the waterfall is reversed. And that's exactly the circumstance that the expert testified he'd never seen in 30 years of being in the RMBS industry. And when we look at the comparable transactions, that to the extent that there are transactions out there that carve out loan modifications from how you calculate distributions, and they put that into the PSA, and it's fully baked into the PSA itself, unlike here, they also protect the risk allocation.
So can I follow up with one more question? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Sure. The examples you put in the record of the other transactions involving mortgage-backed securities, were those adjustable rate mortgage? Did those transactions or trusts involve adjustable rate mortgages?
I don't recall. I don't know that it changes
the analysis.
The analysis,
okay.
But I don't recall.
Thank you.
Do you have a question? I have one. And I'm trying to put all this together as well. You know, for securities purposes and for what you issue to prospective investors is the servicing agreement and the PROSUP, right? Am I correct on that? In other words, when you're trying to induce investors.
Well, Wells Fargo is not involved in that. I don't think the servicing agreement necessarily goes. I mean, the PROSUP is a marketing document, yes.
Okay. But the PSA is not something that's provided to investors. Is that your understanding?
No, a PSA is publicly available. It is absolutely provided to investors.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And in fact, when you look at a PROSUP, and this is in the record, and it's made into the district court's findings, that the PROSUP, in fact, will say, here's a summary, but if you really want to know what's happening, you have to read the PSA. Go to the PSA for the actual contract language.
But I just want to make sure I understand this. When you do the mortgage loan modification, you're only modifying the term of the payment, not the ultimate payout of the note. In other words, you may get another few years to pay, but you're going to pay the same amount. Is that
you know, a modification can take different forms?
A modification where it's reduced?
Yes, it can be.
In other words, there's a discharge of part of the loan?
Yes, essentially.
Okay.
Or rather, it could reduce the interest rate.
Yes. Yes, it could exactly reduce the interest rate.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
One thing I didn't have a chance to talk about was the standard of review here. It's kind of interesting because, as you know, the trial judge just disappeared, and this dropped on the desk of another judge who kicked it to another judge. So the judge who made this decision, I feel sorry for her because, 10, something like that, just drop on her desk. And she's like, so she had no chance to judge credibility of the witnesses, et cetera. I just want to bring that up. I didn't see any precedent what happens when the judge quits and somebody else takes over.
Well, I know you're from Dallas, right?
Right.
And this, I haven't seen anything like this. I mean, right. This is unusual. It's all occurred, so anyway.
Totally. I believe you. So a couple of issues. First off, PSA does not address modifications at all in this deal, so it's just silent on it. So there's nothing contradictory, frankly, in our view, in the PSA. Secondly, when we talk about Wells Fargo's reading of the documents, testimony is very clear that they only read the black lines because they were in a hurry. So they only read the changes from prior deals. This didn't appear in the changes from prior deals for whatever reason, probably because it was in a prior deal. Right? And so they just never looked at it. They never looked at the servicing agreement.
You mean Section 404 of the servicing agreement?
404 servicing agreement, as far as I know, in its entirety, because they didn't even know that this language was in the pooling and servicing agreement. They didn't know this was in there, and this is shot. They found this out at trial, that this is from servicing agreement Section 705. It says, the servicing agreement will inure to the benefit of and be binding upon the parties hereto, the certificate holders, the security administrator, that's the respondent, and their respective successors and permitted assigns. So this servicing agreement, this separate agreement, is binding on the certificate holders and the securities administrator. And that's important. They didn't know that was in there. That's why they never looked at it. If they'd known it was in there, they obviously, I would hope, they would have looked at it in calculating the payments under
the
waterfall.
Let me ask you, though, the same question I ask counsel for the respondents. I mean, is there any question that the servicing agreement is the contract that governs how the servicer handles the underlying individual mortgage loans?
That is a true statement, and I want to get to your point on that.
All right.
Because
the PSA handles how the money's distributed. It has the waterfall distribution that we're concerned about.
It does have the waterfall distribution.
And that handles the investors, right? It handles investors are paid.
How the investors are paid and how the trust is administered on a day-to-day basis. Now, your correction, your reading of it doesn't work, unfortunately.
Okay.
With all
well,
due respect.
Why doesn't it work?
Right.
Could it not be read that this refers to that the servicing agreement, which deals with how you handle the underlying individual mortgage loans, that pertains to that situation?
It cannot, because that would address a borrower, right? So you're saying this addresses how you deal with borrowers. Well, right. Then what that would say is the mortgage rate, net mortgage rate as to any mortgage loan will be deemed not reduced by a servicing modification. Okay, so that's how you handle borrowers. So I'm modifying your loan, Mr. Smith, you're paying less interest, but I'm gonna deem it not reduced by the servicing modification, so you're actually paying the same rate of interest. That wouldn't make any sense, and it wouldn't do any good to do that. Secondly, look at the end of the sentence where it says, so that the calculation of accrued note interest payable on the offered certificates, which is a defined term, will not be affected by the servicing modification. So to make that work, payable on the offered certificates gets written completely out of the contract. And offered certificates is a defined term. That's the Libramax certificates. That's the certificates that all the certificate holders own. So that unfortunately doesn't work.
I'm sorry. Did you want to follow? What about respondents' argument that your interpretation would basically turn this deal on its head and the Class A, who are supposed to get paid first, would be in a lesser position than the Class XP?
Let's unpack that. First off, we're both senior certificates. Very clear from the PSA. I think it was finding 11 in the findings of fact by the judge. So we're both senior certificates. Doesn't turn anything on its head. Secondly, think what he just said. Okay, listen to what he said. Tell me if it makes sense. A's get paid in full first, and then the XPs get paid. And somehow, when the A's get paid, that doesn't change. That doesn't change under the administration by deeming no reduction. It's just that there's more money left over to pay the XPs. If the A's are getting paid in full, they don't get robbed no matter what. That doesn't make any sense.
That's my question for you. Under your interpretation of Section 404, does that affect the amount that Class A gets paid?
I don't know that it does necessarily, because if they're getting paid in full prior, which is not changing, then it's just more monies there for the XP, probably due to servicer advances.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So, well, before you go, explain how you view these two, you know, the waterfall distribution formula and this work together, and what can you point us to that you believe make both work together?
Yeah, I mean, I go back to Judge Cochran's point about the definition of mortgage rate. The definition of mortgage rate clearly to me excludes servicing modifications, because those are not pursuant to the terms of the mortgage note. That is a separate thing that takes place outside of the mortgage note. That's a modification by its very terms. So that makes the whole thing work together cohesively, right? Because the A's are all, the A's and the XP's are senior certificates. They take pro rata under the PSA. So I don't get the logic of their position, because it doesn't make any sense to me that they're paid in full, but somehow they get robbed. That doesn't make sense. And so I think the logic of their position is untenable, frankly. So the way I see the deal working and how it was supposed to be structured was you have XPs and A's who are seniors. They take pro rata under 4.01. That's the deal that everybody made and signed up for, frankly. And then if you look at their definition of mortgage rate, which their whole argument really hinges on, you know, counsel went right to mortgage rate when he stood up to talk to you, and you had some good questions that I don't think were ever answered, which is how is that included in a modification when it has to be done pursuant to the terms of the mortgage note? Modifications don't take place pursuant to terms of mortgage note. They're special, and they were new, and that's why this deal has this in the servicing agreement, because we needed modifications, but we didn't want to rob the XP holder who was interest only, so we put that in there to protect them so someone would buy that strip.
But I'm looking at the definition of net mortgage rate, and it does define it as a per annum rate of interest equal to the then applicable mortgage rate.
And then look at the definition
the
of mortgage rate.
But the applicable mortgage rate isn't so.
But when you just said then applicable mortgage rate,
right?
I bet you mortgage rate was capitalized, isn't it?
It is.
Okay, so you have to go to the definition of mortgage rate. And what does mortgage rate say? Mortgage rate says exactly what we talked about, which was
annual rate at which interest accrues on such mortgage loan as adjusted from time to time in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note.
In accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note. Has to be adjusted in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note. If it is not, then it does not meet the definition of mortgage rate. There had to be something in this deal for when a loan was adjusted not in accordance with the provisions of the mortgage note, and that's why the language is in the servicing agreement.
Why wouldn't it be in the PSA too?
Don't know. They never put any testimony on about it. Nobody knows. It would have been great if they had gotten one of the 85 lawyers who were on this deal to come in and testify as to why that wasn't on there. But all they could do is get somebody who said, we only read the black lines.
Okay.
But you didn't offer any testimony to that effect.
We didn't exist. We don't. The witness from Libramax, I think, was in high school.
My point is you didn't have any testimony as to why this is something that's normally in a PSA versus not.
No, there was testimony that this language appears in other PSAs, in other similar contracts. So they put on testimony that this happens in other deals, and I'm just reading from their brief, but it's in the PSA. And then they say, you know, where this concept is actually incorporated into the PSA, the servicer provides the unmodified mortgage rates to the securities administrator. So they're essentially, they concede, I think, that this language occurs in other deals. It just happened to be in the PSA. It didn't make it into this one. This whole problem would have been solved had they just read the document.
All right, let me ask you this, though, and maybe I'm missing something. If there's a modification, you're usually receiving less money, right?
Of course.
But you're saying that that cannot be taken into account when you're paying the investor. Where does that money come from?
So there's two concepts that we talked about earlier. One is servicing advances, where the servicer advances as though the mortgage is being paid normally, and expects, essentially makes a loan to the trust that they expect to be paid back later. And then the second concept is that of the fact that the XP&A share pro rata. So if there's a reduction, there's a pro rata share in that, but it's going to go less to the XP because interest rates are, they get paid interest.
Okay. Anything further? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Presenting this very interesting case. We will take the matter under advisement, and I'm sure we'll be looking at it very closely. And I do appreciate your briefing and arguments this morning. Thank you.
Your Honor.